plastic? A toxic love story?
The city was in the midst of this huge debate over whether or not to ban plastic bags. And it started me thinking about plastic and realizing that plastic, you know, is ubiquitous. And it also made me start wondering to what extent it had kind of shaped our lives.
That's Susan Frankel. We talked to her about her fascinating exploration into our plastic world. It's called plastic. And global warming is dangerous to your health.
Health is not just the absence of disease, it's a state of well-being. And that well-being depends on having a healthy environment around us.
That's science journalist Dan Ferber. We'll talk to him about Changing Planet, Changing Health, the book he co-wrote with epidemiologist Dr. Paul Epstein. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm old enough to remember the scene in the movie The Graduate where Dustin Hoffman's character is advised by his girlfriend's father to get into, quote, plastics. Back then, plastics were the up-and-coming thing. Now, we can't get away from them. They define the modern era. They are the stuff of our material life. Plastics are convenient, but have we made a pact with the devil? Disturbing research has emerged ever more strongly over the years, showing that plastics are bringing a slew of serious toxins to our environment. Toxins that may be contributing to our obesity epidemic, cancer, birth defects, and learning disabilities. They're bad for wildlife, too, with birds and fish choking on plastic bags, huge gyres of plastic rotating in the ocean, and bizarre changes in the sexual behavior and reproductive health of species. Will we have to give plastics up, or can we find safer ways to make them? Susan Frankel's book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, examines the place of this protean material in our daily lives, from design and convenience to hazard and, hopefully, solutions. Susan Frankel is a science writer. Her work has appeared in such venues as Discover, Reader's Digest, Smithsonian, The New York Times, and Real Simple. Susan Frankel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
In this book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, in its early pages, you list all the plastic items that you touch in the course of just your early morning routine. Do you happen to have the book there?
Yeah, I do.
I wonder if you could read, I think it's on page 2. Would you mind reading these?
You want me to read the list?
Yeah.
Okay. Alarm clock, mattress, heating pad, eyeglasses, toilet seat, toothbrush, toothpaste, tube and cap, wallpaper, Corian counter, light switch, tablecloth, Cuisinart, electric tea kettle, refrigerator handle, bag of frozen strawberries, scissors handle, yogurt container, lid for can of honey, juice pitcher, milk bottle, seltzer bottle, lid of cinnamon jar, bread bag, cellophane wrapping of box of tea, packaging of tea bag, thermos, spatula handle, a bottle of dish soap, bowl, cutting board, baggies, computer, fleece sweatshirt, sports bra, yoga pants, sneakers, tub containing cat food, cup inside tub to scoop out the kibble, dog leash, Walkman, newspaper bag, stray packet of mayo on sidewalk, garbage can.
Wow. And that's just the first few hours of your day.
Exactly. First hour of my day.
Oh, my God. And so you came up, when you totted up all these items, the plastic and the non-plastic items, and by the end of the day, you had like almost 200 plastic and just a little over 100 of non-plastic. That's a 2-to-1 ratio. Were you surprised?
Well, I was, because if you saw the house that I live in and saw the way I live, you know, you would think that I was kind of a natural fabrics, you know, eco, groovy kind of person. I mean, I live in a house with a lot of woodwork and old furniture, and we don't have a lot of appliances or stuff. And so that was a big surprise to me, to look around and realize that my life was very much permeated by synthetic materials without me trying in the least, and in fact, in some cases, sort of actively not trying.
So what got you interested in doing this book?
Well, I live in San Francisco, where there's been a lot of talk about plastic for probably much longer than is true in other parts of the country. And at the time that I started working on this or started thinking about it, the city was in the midst of this huge debate over whether or not to ban plastic bags. And it started me thinking about plastic and realizing that plastic, you know, is ubiquitous, as when I did this little sort of thought experiment for myself where I decided to try to, you know, go a day without touching anything plastic. And it also made me start wondering to what extent it had kind of shaped our lives. And, you know, it was one of these things that was so ubiquitous as to be invisible, and yet, as I started to think about it, seemed to be having pretty profound effects on the way that we live.
And it's not really that old. You know, I recently have been staying at my mother's house, which has a lot of what you call, I think, mid-century modern vintage items, you know, items from the 1950s and 60s. And it's amazing to me how many are not plastic than, like, for example, metal curtain, shower curtain hooks, which I don't probably have not been around for at least 30 or 40 years, but she has them. So tell us, how did this plastic era start, and when did it start?
Well, you can fix the date to a lot of different, you know, you can date the start of the plastics era to a lot of different times. I mean, some people would take it back to the mid-19th century, where people began to be concerned about natural materials running out. There was a lot of worry about, for instance, ivory disappearing because so many elephants were being hunted to supply ivory. And that was sort of a spur for the development of the first plastics, like celluloid, which was then used to mimic ivory in people's uses. Or, you know, you could fix the date to the early 20th century, which is when Leo Baekeland invented Bakelite, which was the first truly synthetic, completely human-made plastic. Or, you know, probably more realistically, you could date it to World War II, when the military, in an effort to kind of conserve strategic metals, said, let's look for plastic to replace them wherever we can, and that came into use both, you know, as acrylic windows on airplanes to, you know, nylon parachutes to bugles, which went from being made from brass to plastic. When it really came into daily life was after the war. You know, all these manufacturers had built up huge production capacity to keep the military going during World War II, and now all that excess production capacity had to go into somewhere. And that's when you really started to see a flood of plastics into everyday life.
You also go into some of the, the aesthetic aspects of plastic, the design aspects of plastic, and you focus in on a number of different objects, iconic objects, one of which is the monobody plastic resin chair. The one that, you know, I have on my porch, and it's just ubiquitous all over the world. Talk a little bit about the history of this chair, or why did you use this as one of your foci?
Well, I was looking for objects. I tell the story of plastic through these different objects, and I was looking for objects that would allow me to explore different themes that I knew were part of the story. So the chair you talk about, the monoblock plastic chair, we've all seen them. You can get them, you know, for less than it costs us to buy a six-pack of beer. Was interesting to me because it is kind of the epitome of, you know, tacky furniture now. Most people, you know, we all have them, but nobody showcases them. But when I started kind of looking at the history of that chair, I realized that if you trace back the technology, where it takes you is to the mid-20th century, when designers were being introduced to the new plastics and were really excited about the possibilities that these plastics presented. You know, here were these materials that you could do anything with. I mean, they brought a kind of freedom that artists had never had before. And the story that I tell in my book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, is about this effort to create a chair out of a single piece of plastic. And it was this really intriguing challenge to designers. And the person who sort of cracked that was this Danish designer, Werner Panton, who came up with a design that was for, it's hard to describe, but I think we've all seen them. It's sort of an S-shaped zigzag of plastic that he came up with in the late 60s, and it was a beautiful chair and a really sexy, kind of exciting chair, and he was able to do it in one single mold as opposed to having to attach the legs separately, which had been this big kind of technological barrier for people who were trying to do it. That became the basis then for, you know, other manufacturers to see, okay, well, we can make a single-shot chair, and people figured out how to do it a lot cheaper with a lot cheaper materials, and, you know, 20 years later, what we end up with are these kind of crappy plastic patio chairs.
Now, you know, plastics, yeah, we probably couldn't live as conveniently without them, but we've been living pretty toxically with them, as you say in your book, Susan Frankel, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. You say in one chapter that we are all a little bit plastic. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, that is a quote from a newspaper story in the early 70s reporting on a study that showed that people had traces in their bloodstreams of a chemical called phthalates, a family of chemicals that are used to soften vinyl and make it kind of flexible and pliable. And the problem is that they leach out pretty readily from soft vinyls. And so people, as this newspaper article reported, were picking up traces of phthalates from all sorts of everyday objects they use. Now, phthalates are just one of many chemicals that are either used in the production of plastics, making the basic raw plastic, or that are added to, you know, give a plastic a certain property, maybe to make it hard and clear, or to make it soft and flexible, or whatever, to make it last longer. Biomonitoring studies have shown since the 70s that we are all picking up trace amounts of these various chemicals. We're all not just a little bit plastic, but we're all a little bit fire retardants, and we're all a little bit solvents, and we're all a little bit bactericides, and, you know, a whole roster of chemicals. The big question is, what does that mean for our health? And that is is indeed a big question.
Yeah, we're always hearing things like, well, you know, these are trace amounts, the levels are too low to really have any effect. But you put your sights square on this idea of the dose-response relationship, that is, you know, that there's some threshold below which we're totally safe. And you say, no, there's some real indications that that's not true. What is this about, and why may it not be the case that you actually have thresholds that are safe?
Well, you know, the classic tenet of toxicology was always that the dose makes the poison. The more you're exposed to, the more poisonous it is. And, you know, take the example of aspirin. You know, 2 aspirins will make you better, 10 aspirins will give you a stomach ache, and 40 aspirins can kill you. That's the way that toxicologists traditionally understood how we were at risk from, you know, hazardous substances. But there's the science on that is changing, and what people are starting to realize is the poison may not be in the dose. It may actually be in the timing, depending, and this is not with all, you know, hazardous substances, but with some, and particularly with some like phthalates, which the kind of impact they have is they interfere with our hormones. They affect things like estrogen or testosterone or other hormones that govern the way our bodies develop. And in that case, what can happen is if you are exposed to one of these chemicals at certain critical periods of development, even a very small amount can have a pretty profound effect. You know, being a little bit plastic when you're a fetus in the womb or when you're a brand new baby or perhaps when you're a teenager and sexually developing, then being a little bit plastic might have bigger problems. And they may be problems that you don't even know about until, you know, years or decades later. And it's I think are all familiar with the story of DEF, the drug that was given to women in the 50s to prevent miscarriages. And 30 years later, 20 years later, the daughters and sons of those women started turning up with cancers, in some cases very rare cancers that were related to that in utero exposure to a synthetic hormone.
Yes, in fact, I am a DES daughter.
Okay.
Now, there's a fascinating story behind this also, and it's a story of Teal Colburn. I remember a long time ago reading her book, Our Stolen Future. She talked about plastics as being these estrogenic chemicals. It's a very interesting story about how she discovered this also, that these things have effects at extremely minute doses that are even too low to measure. Tell us about her.
She's a really interesting story. Theo Colburn, I think, was trained as a pharmacist, grew up on a ranch, and she lives in Colorado, in rural Colorado, and started hearing concerns about pollutants in the river near her home, I think, if I remember this right. And that just got her interested in water issues, and she ended up going back to school and getting a master's, I think, in freshwater ecology, and then going on and studying zoology. And, you know, in the late 80s, by that time she had raised four kids and, you know, was at an age where a lot of people are starting to think about retirement. She got a job with, I believe it was the Conservation Foundation, to do a study looking at the effects of industrial pollutants on wildlife in the Great Lakes. She's somebody, I say, is in the book, is somebody who has a talent for sort of going through, you know, mounds and mounds of data and spotting patterns. And so she started going through, you know, these huge piles of studies about wildlife in the Great Lakes. And she was expecting that she was going to see sort of classic signs of, you know, industrial toxins, things like cancer or birth defects. And instead, what was turning up were these kind of weird reports of things like male gulls with female cells in their testes, or female gulls nesting together in nests. And when she sort of assembled all these facts into a spreadsheet, what she realized is that what linked these kind of disparate symptoms was they all could be related to disruptions in the endocrine system, which again is this kind of network of glands that govern development. And furthermore, what she realized is, you know, it was top predators who were showing signs, which is always an indication that something working up through the food chain, and that the adults who had been exposed seemed okay, but that the worst impacts were in their offspring. And so she speculated that what she was seeing were signs of chemicals having these kind of endocrinological effects, and that they were transgenerational. Boy, two big words I'm stumbling on. But basically that, you know, these were things that were affecting development, and they were skipping generations, much like DES had done. But DES was a drug that was designed to be a synthetic estrogen. These were chemicals that were not designed to be estrogenic, and yet, you know, they seemed to be having estrogenic effects.
And having effects on things like, as you say in the book, Susan Frankel, in your book Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, effects like learning disabilities, our obesity epidemic, as well as things like cancer and birth defects.
Right. All that said, I do feel like I need to add a note so people don't, you know, feel a sense of panic. The science on this is really new, and it's really uncertain. It's like, I think about it like, you know, we have, if you imagine a bulletin board and you stick a thumbtack up here and a thumbtack down there and a thumbtack over here, there's all these kind of little troubling signs. Not all the dots have been connected yet, and we don't really, the bottom line is we really don't entirely know or understand what this barrage of synthetic chemicals that we're exposed to every day are really doing, what the full extents are. There are disturbing signs, and it's plausible, and it's backed up by some animal and, you know, cell studies. It's plausible that the kinds of actions these chemicals can induce could lead to effects ranging from ADD to obesity to cancer, but we don't know for sure, and that's, you know, really where you start to get into the policy debate. So what do you do with that uncertainty?
Well, but here in terms of the policy, there's a vast difference, I think, between what we do in the U.S. and what they do in Europe, where a lot of these chemicals are banned.
Right, and I think, you know, the reason that is that the Europeans operate from a precautionary perspective and say, you know.
Explain that, yeah.
You know, as I understand it, the basic idea is, you know, if there appears to be reasonable evidence that something is capable of causing a health problem, to put it really simply, then you take action. And in the U.S., our chemical policies tend to operate from the assumption that a chemical is safe until proven to be dangerous. And the laws are written in such a way that make it very difficult to establish that proof, for regulators to establish that proof. European laws are written with the burden of proof on manufacturers to demonstrate safety before a chemical can be put on the market. So we err on the side of caution. And, you know, so I look at something like phthalates. You know, there is a lot of uncertainty about phthalates. It is by no means an established case that they are dangerous. On the other hand, we know they leach out of vinyl. We know that they're getting into people. So why take the risk? Especially when they're, in the case of, you know, some of these phthalates, there are ready alternatives available.
Now, you spoke before about getting interested in this when there was a controversy over issuing a ban, a plastic bag ban. Talk a little bit about what's going on in the area of plastic. You know, we started hearing when you're in the checkout line at the supermarket, paper or plastic. A lot of people don't know which is more environmentally safe. You weigh in on this. What are your conclusions?
Well, my conclusion is the answer to that question is neither. That the best, you know, environmentally sound decision is to bring your own bag back to the store. That said, that paper or plastic question has become politically charged because when you actually look hard at the environmental impacts of the two, paper actually doesn't come out so great compared to plastic. It takes more energy to produce, more greenhouse gases are produced in the production and use of paper bags. They use more water. They're, you know, more expensive to transport, take up more space. But paper bags have one thing over plastic bags, which is when they get into the environment, they break down, and plastic bags don't. That said, these are both single-use products. They're both bags that require, you know, use of finite natural resources, fossil fuels in one case, trees in the other, to create something that you use for, you know, maybe 15 minutes to get your groceries from the store to the front door. And, you know, we went eons carrying stuff without carrying it in disposable bags. So I really feel like the answer to that question ought to be, you know, bring your own bag. And it can be made of anything. As long as you're using it over and over again, you are mitigating the environmental impacts that went into producing it.
And also lessening its likelihood of ending up in something that just sounds truly horrible, these huge gyres in the ocean, these gyres of rotating plastics. Talk about them and their impact on wildlife.
Well, you know, that truly is sort of the demonstration of the long reach of our throwaway culture, you know, seeing plastic thousands of miles from land. One guy I talked to compared it to finding a Twinkie in outer space. Unfortunately, I think there's been this whole picture that people have in their mind that there are these, you know, Texas-sized islands of trash in the middle of the ocean. And unfortunately, what's there is something that is really kind of much more insidious, which is just huge areas of the ocean where the water column is diffuse with tiny little plastic particles, fragments that are left over when plastic is pounded into bits by the waves or broken up by the sun. And it's kind of this confetti of plastic, and it's not something you can see. You can't, you know, go onto Google Satellite and see it, and it's even can be hard to see right there when you're in the middle of these areas. The one in the North Pacific has gotten a lot of publicity, but there are actually at least four others in the world's oceans. So there's, you know, there's different impacts on wildlife. On the one hand, before those plastic pieces of debris get broken up, you've got bigger pieces, and wildlife can, you know, get entangled in it. Abandoned, discarded nets that are now made of nylon are a huge problem for wildlife. In fact, you know, more than 200 species of animals have been documented to be injured or killed by plastic debris. But a lot of people now are more worried about, even more worried about these little tiny bits. And the reason is they are like magnets for pollutants that are already in the ocean. And they just sop them up and concentrate them by, you know, anywhere from 10,000 to a million times. And I'm talking about them becoming laced with things like PCBs, persistent chemical, or DDT, which, you know, has been outlawed since the early 70s, but is out there still in the ocean. And the danger is that these little bits are eaten by fish. We know, in fact, that they're eaten by fish, by small fish that in turn can be eaten by bigger fish and bigger and bigger and bigger till you get up to us at the top of the food chain. Now, again, in truth, we don't actually know the full implications of that. It's not entirely clear whether if a fish eats one of these kind of little tiny time bombs, whether the chemicals that are on them can get into the fish's tissues. But, you know, the idea that they're out there is quite disturbing, certainly something we need to know more about.
Right. So what can we do about plastics? Or must we get rid of them, especially in a world in which all the other resources are beginning to run out? Can they be made less toxic? You know, you talk about controlling at the source instead of the end stage. What are some solutions to these problems of toxic plastic?
Well, I think the solutions come at, you know, to all of us who have a stake in plastics. We can't get rid of them. They're too much firmly embedded in our lives and, you know, in many ways for the better, as in medicine. You know, a lot of good stuff comes from plastic in medicine. And even in, you know, coping with climate change, you know, we want lighter weight planes and cars and solar panels. But I think that there are things that can happen from both, you know, the policy level at manufacturing and by us as consumers that would make a difference. So, you know, let's start with us buying plastic stuff. Be more conscious. Look for ways to get things that aren't completely swaddled in plastic packaging. Take care to recycle. That old mantra, reduce, reuse, and recycle, really applies here, and it can make a difference. I think manufacturers need to be held accountable for the products they put into the marketplace, and I don't think we can rely on, you know, just consumer pressure to do that. I think we need policies like extended producer responsibility policies that make manufacturers pay for the disposal of the products that they put into the marketplace. When that happens, you end up with companies using less packaging, using more recyclable packaging, and you see recycling rates going up. I think government needs to, you know, enact tougher chemical policies that shift the burden of proof so that manufacturers have to demonstrate that their products and the chemicals that they're using are safe for our health and the environment.
Are there more environmentally friendly plastics on the horizon as well?
Well, there's a whole big push right now to make plastics out of renewable sources like plants. People call them bioplastics. Bioplastics, I feel like every answer I give you there's good and bad. Bioplastics offer a lot of promise. They get us away from fossil fuels, and that's good for sort of climate change accounting, carbon accounting. But unless you make a commitment to make them so that they're biodegradable or recyclable, you know, we'll have the same problems again. Unless you make a commitment to ensure that they don't contain toxic chemicals, we have the same problem again. I mean, I'm hopeful that since, you know, there is this interest in making quote-unquote green plastics, that we might get it right the same time around. On the other hand, one of the big problems in our current uses of plastic is the fact that half of all plastics produced go into single-use stuff, like those bags at the grocery store or drinking straws. And that's a habit that we have to break, and bioplastics alone aren't going to be the answer to that. That's also going to require, you know, changes on the part of consumers.
Well, this is a fascinating and actually, I have to say, very entertaining book to read. Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, Our Love Affair with Plastic, I think you're referring to. Susan Frankel, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Susan Frankel writes about science for Discover, Reader's Digest, Smithsonian, The New York Times, and Real Simple, among others. She won a 2008 National Outdoor Book Award for a previous book, American Chestnut. You can read an excerpt from Plastic by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk to science journalist Dan Ferber about climate change and human health. Stay tuned after the break. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Ella era una chica plástica, de esas que veo por ahí, de esas que cuando se agitan sudan Chanel number 3, que sueñan casarse con un doctor, pues él puede mantenerlas mejor. No le hablan a nadie si no es su igual, a menos que sea fulano de tal. Son lindas, delgadas, de buen vestir, de mirada esquiva y falso reír. Él era un muchacho plástico, de esos que veo por ahí, con la peinilla en la mano y cara de yo no fui, de los que por tema en conversación discuten qué marca de carro es mejor, de los que prefieren el no comer por las apariencias que hay que tener para andar elegantes y así poder una chica plástica recoger.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We know that global warming is bad for us, but what about its connection to disease? Dan Ferber connects the dots between changes in the global environment and human health. In the book he co-wrote, Changing Planet, Changing Health, he talks about why epidemics of cholera, malaria, dengue fever, and tick-borne diseases are spreading. The book also talks about ways we can prepare for and meet the climate challenges to our health by strengthening our warning systems for disease, making our cities cooler, and beefing up our public health systems. Dan Ferber co-wrote the book with Dr. Paul Epstein, who's the director of the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard. Ferber tells a thrilling story of how Epstein got involved in fighting epidemics and went on to make the connection between disease and our changing environment. Dan Ferber is a science journalist who's written widely about health, the environment, and biology. In Changing Planet, Changing Health, Ferber and Epstein define health more broadly than just tackling disease. I asked Dan Ferber to define the framework of health that the book takes.
Health is not just the absence of disease, it's a state of well-being. And that well-being depends on having a healthy environment around us. We all need clean air. We all need pure water. We all need healthy food. And this comes from having healthy nature around us, forests and rivers and wetlands and healthy land to grow crops. So we try to make these connections clear because climate change is causing a lot of changes to these systems that could affect us down the line.
Dr. Paul Epstein's work is at the center of the book, Changing Planets, Changing Health. The Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard, which Epstein directs, is the first one of its type at a major medical school to look at health effects of climate change. Epstein is also on the International Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, the major global scientific body that informs world leaders about climate change. I asked Dan Ferber how Epstein got involved in the whole issue of climate change and health.
He had an interesting journey. He started out as a physician trained in tropical medicine and public health. He was trained in tropical medicine, and he did a lot of work internationally, particularly in Mozambique, and we describe that in the book. And then he trained in public health to kind of broaden his understanding of health and disease, and then later on started connecting those things to the environment, and then thinking a lot about climate change, searched far and wide for solutions. And in doing that, he's an interesting guy. He moved away from his silo. A lot of academics stay in their specialty, and he moved out and he started working with people in the business world, in the finance sector. He started working with people in international diplomacy. He wanted real-world solutions. And that journey, that story, really intrigued me.
Let's start talking about epidemics and the connection between those and what's happening with climate change. I read in the book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, that you wrote with Dr. Paul Epstein, that there are now 40 diseases that are new to medicine that have surfaced since 1946. Why this increase, and is there a connection between this and climate change?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and the question you articulate right there is exactly the question that got Dr. Epstein going about 20 years ago, and not just him, but a bunch of his colleagues at Harvard Medical School and other universities, and they wanted to know exactly that. They wanted to know, why has there been this increase in infectious disease since the mid 1970s is when it really started taking off. And they suspected that it had something to do with global environmental change, and they investigated it quite a bit. In the case of infectious disease, there are some concrete links, certain infectious diseases in particular, infectious diseases that are carried by insects and related animals, other cold-blooded animals, so that small temperature changes affect the functioning of insects a lot. So, for example, we talk about malaria in the book. The mosquitoes that carry malaria in sub-Saharan Africa, like all mosquitoes, very, very sensitive to temperature, as are the parasites that carry malaria, which live inside the mosquito. So just a couple of degrees of warming in an area can make the difference between no malaria and malaria epidemics. And that's what we're seeing in the highland areas of East Africa. And I saw that by traveling around Kenya with a malaria biologist named Indra Githeko, who's been studying this since the 90s. What's happening is that in the highland areas where people used to live, because there was no malaria, but climate change has warmed East Africa a bit, and it's enough to expand the range of the malaria-carrying mosquitoes. And this is a similar story to what's happening in other places. You could say that the tropics are getting bigger. They're moving away from the equator. Areas that were not tropical are becoming tropical. Areas that were more temperate are becoming a little more subtropical, getting a little warmer everywhere. So the range of these disease-carrying insects and other creatures is expanding, and as well higher into the mountains.
Is malaria going to be a problem for such countries as the European countries or even the U.S.?
It's unlikely that it's going to come back to the U.S. Malaria was a problem in the United States. I mean, where I live in Indiana, in eastern Illinois, when the settlers first came in, there was malaria. We got malaria under control in this country by mosquito control, and we have very good mosquito control, so it's unlikely it's going to come back here. What we're a little more concerned about in this country is dengue fever. Dengue fever is rampant in Central America, in the Caribbean, in South America, and it's a nasty disease. It's like a very bad case of the flu. They call it breakbone fever. It feels like, you know, it feels so painful. That's where the name came from. And it lasts for a week or two. And people usually get over it, but there's a variant of it called dengue hemorrhagic fever. So if you get it a second time, it can potentially cause a lot of internal bleeding like Ebola, and it can be fatal. So we had the first dengue fever outbreak in 65 years in Key West, Florida 2 years ago. So the range of dengue fever, it's very likely to expand into the southern states. This is carried by a different type of mosquito.
So you're talking about insect vectors, I believe they're called, insects that are carrying disease that are widening. One disease that affects our area and, in fact, has personally affected my family are tick-borne diseases.
Absolutely.
My mother, several years ago, got babesiosis out on eastern Long Island. I know somebody else who's gotten that last year. That was recently an extremely rare disease and now is becoming more common. It's like malaria, in fact. So talk about, you know, tick-borne diseases and how their range is expanding.
Yeah, changing planet, changing health. We talk a lot about Lyme disease, which is the most common vector-borne infectious disease in the United States, vector meaning an animal and carried by an animal such as a tick. And it has expanded for several reasons. One of them is the warming climate in the Northeast. Another one has to do with people moving into areas that used to be intact forest. But so in the past decade alone, Lyme disease has become 10 times more common in Maine and 8 times more common in New Hampshire. And that's just since 2000. And the reason is that it used to be too cold in the winter for these ticks to overwinter, and now it's not. And it's also predicted to move into eastern Canada, where it's not present right now. So the idea is that it's getting warmer in the Northeast. It's getting warmer in eastern North America in general. And, the range of this tick is expanding.
And I'm talking with Dan Ferber. He's co-author with Dr. Paul Epstein of Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Talk about cholera. Cholera is one of the dreaded, plague diseases of the past. How did this get started again?
So there have been outbreaks of cholera periodically through history. In fact, Dr. Epstein encountered the first cholera epidemic in southeastern Africa when he was working in Mozambique in the late 1970s, and he had firsthand experience fighting that epidemic. And we tell that story in the book. It was a harrowing experience. They saved a lot of lives. They weren't able to save everybody. At the time, he'll say that they had no idea there was any link with climate or with environmental change. And that research actually came later, and it was done by Dr. Rita Caldwell of the University of Maryland, who has been director of the National Science Foundation since then. Illustrious career, a lot of it working on the microbes that cause cholera and related microbes. So the connection that she made is she had a question that no one had ever really answered. What happens in those many years between epidemics? So if the cholera is caused by a bacteria, the bacteria has to survive somehow. Nobody knew where it went. And she found that it lived in the ocean in this dormant form. And she also found that it jumped onto these plankton, these tiny animals and plants in the sea. Actually, it's on the shells of tiny animals. So when the climate warms, the coastal waters warm, there are more storms that can carry the plankton inland, it would carry the cholera bacteria inland in Bangladesh, very low-lying areas, wet areas. And that started the cholera epidemic. So that's her research, and that was going on in the 80s primarily, and that gave Dr. Epstein an epiphany. The epiphany being that some kind of change in the environment might have something to do with infectious disease.
We're going into the pollen season soon. Is there a connection between pollen and climate change, and how serious of a problem might that be?
Oh, that's really interesting. And yes, there is. And that was actually work that Dr. Epstein did in the late 90s or around 2000, along with a scientist named Lou Ziska at U.S. Department of Agriculture. The connection is that as carbon dioxide levels rise, ragweed produces more pollen. And not only does it produce more pollen, but it produces more potent pollen. And ragweed is the cause of allergies, about 90% of hay fever in the early fall. In the spring, there's some other types of pollen that irritate people, tree pollen and grasses. And so, but ragweed is the primary cause of hay fever in the late summer and early fall in most of this country. And There's the connection right there. Carbon dioxide increases the pollen levels. There's another aspect of that, too. So the root cause of all this increase in carbon dioxide is burning fossil fuels. It's been known for a long time that tailpipe pollutants and smokestack pollutants irritate the lining of the lungs, cause bronchitis, trigger asthma attacks, and I'm talking about the black soot that comes out of truck exhaust. I'm talking about nitrogen oxide gases called NOx gases and sulfur gases. So these are all pollutants according to the EPA. And these all irritate the lining of the lungs. And what happens is, particularly with the soot particles, they glom onto the pollen and carry the pollen deep into the lungs, into the tiny airways deep in the lungs, which worsens allergies. So you have this combined effect. So all of it traces back to burning fossil fuels. That's the root cause of all of it.
So what you're really saying here is that global warming, increase in temperatures, increase in carbon dioxide, is creating diseases, spread of diseases, more potent problems, but also that the very causes of climate change itself have their own disease problems.
Yeah, exactly. And our entire book And Dr. Epstein's entire approach is a public health approach. In public health, you treat patients, of course. That's what doctors do. If they're sick, you treat them. But a public health approach is about preventing disease. So if you can predict an epidemic and get medicine and medics to an area, you can save a lot of lives. The ultimate way in public health to prevent a problem, you get at the root cause of the problem. And we need to get at the root cause of the problem, which is our dependence on coal, oil, and gas to provide energy for us. We need to move more towards a renewable energy system.
Some people say, you know, greenhouse effect, well, hey, that must be good for plants. What are some issues around that? I mean, are there winners and losers here? And if so, who are they?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And scientists, even through the 90s, looked at it in exactly that way. You know, we're going to see winners and losers, particularly in terms of agriculture and this whole idea of greening the earth that the fossil fuel companies and their various PR people glommed onto, that, you know, as the earth warmed, northern hemisphere would get warm, agricultural yield would increase, crop yields would increase. Well, there's a basis in science for that. Carbon dioxide is food for plants. Certain plants, if you raise the carbon dioxide level, they will grow faster and produce more seeds, leaves, whatever the product is that we eat, essentially. But what scientists found out in the last decade or so, and we described this in the book, is that it's not that simple at all. What they learned is that as carbon dioxide levels rise, so do the insects that eat plants like to eat more of them. And this, what I'm talking about, came from a study on soybeans that was done at the University of Illinois, and we described that in the book. I went there, and there's a really interesting setup there where it's a field of soybean, look like any other field of Illinois soybean, but there is a ring around it and a computerized monitoring system in the center of it, and it pumps out carbon dioxide into that area, and it creates the atmosphere of the mid-21st century, so if we keep on burning fossil fuels like we are. So you can compare, basically you have the atmosphere of 2050, you have the current atmosphere in a plot somewhere else on the land, and you can compare how the soybeans grow. And the insects are free to come and go, any kind of plant disease free to come and go. And what they learned is that in the high CO2 plots, high carbon dioxide plots, the insects that eat these soybeans are going to town. And they've been spending a number of years figuring out why. The expected increase in crops, it's half of what is expected, and that makes a huge difference in terms of feeding the world, and that's how it ties back to human health. I mean, we're struggling to feed 6.5 billion or people we have right now, and the population is increasing, and the prospect of climate change, even a 1 degree increase in global temperature is predicted to cause a 10% decrease in crop yields. So. That can lead to malnutrition in certain areas and even famine in certain areas of the world.
And, of course, an increase, as you say, in the pests, and then probably an increase in the use of pesticides.
The increase in the use of pesticides is part of it, absolutely. And then we have a risk to our water supply, and fresh water is a big issue going forward.
Mm. Now, in your title, in the title of your book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, you talk about what we can do about it. What are some things that we can do? I mean, for example, take heat waves. I was in southern France in 2003.
You were? Oh, boy.
And everybody around me was like wilting on the vine. Of course, I was used to New York summer humidity and heat, so it wasn't so bad for me. But something like 71,000 people died during that. There were excess deaths. What are some things that people can do as we move into a century of more frequent and more extreme heat waves?
Well, there's a lot we can do. And what you described, that European heat wave of 2003, that broke every record on the books. And it was the hottest summer since the 1300s, as they could tell by grape growing records going back to the 1300s. Some of the things that we can do, I'll get to heat waves in a minute, but just as individuals, our public health approach is predicting problems and getting people out of harm's way. And heat waves are a great example of that, because in this country, we've developed heat wave early warning systems, and we talk about that. in Chicago in 1995, 750 people died in that heat wave, and there was no heat wave warning systems. But there was in Philadelphia that same year, and the same hot, massive hot muggy air went to Philadelphia, and you know, it's tragic that 18 people died, but it's not 750. So the difference is a system that tells people, well, stay hydrated, don't go out midday if you're healthy. But particularly the people who are harmed are these elderly and shut-ins, and they can be moved to air-conditioned cooling centers, and that saves lives. I mean, that can keep people from getting heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and all sorts of very serious problems. So it's an example of predicting. So that's something that communities can and have set up around this country. I mean, there's these warning systems are now standard operating procedure in a lot of places. Same thing with epidemics of infectious disease. And we describe Dr. Andrew Gathekel, I mentioned, from Kenya, has developed a model for predicting malaria in that area. And another scientist we talk about from USDA has developed a model for predicting Rift Valley fever. So these are ways of predicting problems, getting doctors, getting medicine, getting medics to a particular area to protect people. The ultimate cause is burning fossil fuels. So we want to get at the root of the problem. And we also talk a lot about what needs to happen as far as what communities need to do and what our country needs to do and what needs to happen internationally. But the way we can connect internationally is we need to let policymakers know that we care about global warming. This is an important issue, and that we need to take action now for the sake of our children and our grandchildren. I mean, and our own health. I mean, this is a serious issue.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dan Ferber about changing planet, changing health. It's about how the climate crisis threatens our health and what we can do about it. He co-wrote the book with Dr. Paul Epstein. And talking about policy issues, one of the things you talk about is an early warning system for epidemics. I'm not sure it made it into the final budget or not, but I know that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, were targeted by the Republicans in Congress for cutting funds. Talk a little bit about what we need to do in terms of public health infrastructure to have early warning systems for epidemics that can help us.
Well, I think if I could just take it from a slightly different angle and think, you know, what do we need to do for public health point of view to prepare for climate change, is every community needs a climate action plan. I believe in the Northeast, a small community in Keene, New Hampshire, actually has one. But a leader in this this idea nationally has been Chicago, and we talk a little bit about Chicago in the book. Since 2008, when they developed their plan, under Mayor Daley, over the past two decades, they've planted 400,000 trees. They've trained workers to install renewable energy technologies rather than traditional technologies. They've added 500 miles of bike lanes, or by 2015, their goal is to add 500 miles of bike lanes or have a bike lane within half a mile of every resident. Green roofs, 2 million square feet of green roofs. That prevents the city from heating up so much during hot summer days, and has a lot of other nice effects too. So a lot of these solutions have a lot of good effects for the health of people. You get people out on their bikes; it keeps people in better shape. It's good for their health overall. In addition, green buildings, a city can promote that. In Chicago, what they do is they fast track permitting. Smart growth to fight sprawl. Instead of people commuting from 50 miles out, you build cities so you have mixed-use, walkable neighborhoods. And so these are things that communities across the country need to do. And it's different in different areas because the risks are slightly different in different areas. If you live along the coast, you have to worry about storms and coastal storm surges, that sort of thing. So you have to make it very customized for your area. So that's what communities can do. Businesses can do a lot, and communities and businesses all need support from national policy. There needs to be national policy changes to favor renewables over fossil fuels.
Now, I wanted to just ask as a last question to you,
sure,
Dan Ferber, something a little bit about how does one become a science journalist? How did you become a science journalist?
So there's a number of paths into it. So I'll tell you mine. I was actually a biologist. I have a PhD in biology, and I thought I was going to be doing research in a lab working on bacteria, and I did that for a few years, and it wasn't for me. And I had always liked the communicating science, and I just liked getting out and talking to people in the community. So I went to journalism school and got a master's in journalism at the University of Illinois, and just really fell in love with storytelling and magazine writing in particular. It was just a form I gravitated to. So I pursued that, and that's how I got into it. And other people come from just straight reporting backgrounds, general reporting backgrounds, you know, covering City Hall. People come from all angles, and they get interested in science, and they have their reporting chops already, and they learn more about science. So people come at it from different angles, and it's all good.
What was your biggest challenge in doing this book?
I think in this book, it was so broad-ranging. The challenge was how to tie it all together. And actually, it wasn't initially obvious, and it took a draft and another draft and some good advice. But the story that tied it all together was Dr. Epstein's story. His journey from a physician to a public health scientist to working with the business world to working with the people at the United Nations, his horizons broadened over the years, over the past two or three decades. So I thought, well, as his horizons broadened, the reader's horizons can broaden, and that was a way to carry the story. Plus, he had so many fascinating experiences. I mean, you know, he helped stop an epidemic of cholera in Mozambique. I mean, that's pretty wild, you know. And he's also been a witness to history. He was at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, very famous environment meeting. He was at Kyoto in 1997 when the climate agreement was crafted. And so he's been pushing for change for a long time at a high level. So he had an interesting viewpoint, an interesting angle that just by tapping his experiences, there were some great stories.
Well, it's a terrific book, Changing Planet, Changing Health, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. You co-wrote the book, Dan Ferber, with Dr. Paul Epstein, and thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thanks very much, Francesca. It's been great to be here.
Dan Ferber writes about the environment, health, and the life sciences. His work has appeared in Reader's Digest, Popular Science, New Scientist, Audubon, Nature Conservancy Magazine, and many other publications. He's also a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine, where he reports on biology, public health, and biotechnology. You can find a link to Dan Ferber's articles at writersvoice.net, including one about the emergence of a new superbug.
Maybe they just ran out of space when they were carving all the things that would happen today and tomorrow. Repulse or sigh in our mind, or a payback time for everything that we borrowed. Maybe it's a baby crying for its mother, and it doesn't understand the lightning or the thunder. Maybe it's a cry of distress from a growing pain, stretch mark freeway span across our bloated belly.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.